Welcome to IT Live, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. That's Paul Wadlington. I'm Texas Homer. It's the Tuesday show, guys. We are going to discuss Texas's realistic win total, but really in a fun way, talking about strength of schedule and how a lot of people's framing totally screws them up and understanding probabilities and how teams can actually win. And also, Paul's going to give you it's a quick crash course for any of you bettors that are making fatal mistakes constantly. and so you're going to learn really quick how to think about these things and not get tricked like, I don't know, 99% of social media. What's up, Ken? And then at the end, we had the list that got dropped of the most active NFL players, and Texas is flying up that board under Sark. So we're going to talk about that too, which programs are actually getting talent in the league, and then which one of our rivals or all of our rivals are not doing so.
Hey, producer.
Yeah.
Can we lead with that?
No, I'm host right now, dude.
Oh, I'm sorry. Host.
Yeah. Host. I'll ask the producer. Let me ask him.
All right. Go black for a second and then come back.
Yeah.
We
can start with
NFL
it.
Stuff?
Yeah, let's lead with it. We can.
All right, let's do it. See, look how flexible Connor is.
Yeah, we're just fun guys, just fun loose guys, man. All right. Most active NFL players, guys.
All right, so this is a chart. If you're not watching on YouTube, we'll do our best to describe it. But it's just a beautiful graphic of the most active NFL players by school. And I was shocked by some of these. Not shocked by at the very top, but shocked by how quickly Texas has cracked the top 10 because of Steve Sarkisian.
Same here.
But also some of the names that are prominent, but also some of the names that are down at the very bottom. Very interesting.
Yeah. So I saw this yesterday. And remember, the whole knock was Texas can't develop. Texas doesn't put guys into the league. We're not hearing that anymore, luckily, with Sark. But that was the big knock. And just to see really in the past 2 years, because remember one of Sark's years, we didn't get anybody into the NFL because he didn't have much to work with, I guess. But now Texas is flying up that board and will continue to climb under the Sarkisian era. So that was interesting. Usual suspects, right? Georgia, Bama, Ohio State, Michigan. Even in Michigan's down year last year, man, they had so many guys in the early rounds. That's pretty wild. LSU's been struggling a bit, but, man, Louisiana has a talent bed. I mean, they just put guys in regardless. Notre Dame doing a good job. Penn State doing a good job. But most importantly, what I wanted to point out, Paul, OU at 45. And remember, this was the whole Sooner base, right? No matter what Texas does, we're the development program. We put guys in the league. So they don't even have that anymore over Texas beyond not being a good program currently. So they've kind of dropped out of there and don't have that weapon to use against us anymore in the recruiting game.
Well, Texas has 50 active NFL players, puts us in the top 10. 23 of those 50 the last 2 years, Connor.
Yeah.
So – You know, I'm writing my Thinking Texas Football preview right now, and I'm doing the position groups. And I mean, we can talk about this maybe in more depth in another one of these shows, but I was looking back at our starting edge room back in 2021 when he first arrived.
Yeah.
Those guys would not make the two deep on the current edge room, and making the three deep would not be guaranteed.
Yeah.
That's like the level of difference. And there's that sort of level change at multiple positions. Edge, I think, is probably the most remarkable
jarring
in that regard. But holy cow, it's amazing. What's interesting, too, is if you kind of break this up into tranches, like groupings, you have Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State at the very top. That should be unsurprising, I think, to everyone, because you're not just looking at recent success. You're looking at the last 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Then you have a tranche of Michigan, LSU, and then you have Notre Dame, Penn State, Texas, Oregon, kind of all in the same tranche. OU, Florida. I mean, Florida and USC are still in the top.
Yeah, no, 15. That's impressive.
That's surprising. And then Auburn, which tells you a lot, right?
Yep.
As underachieving as they've been, they're still putting out raw talent. And then Iowa is in the top 20, which is, to me, that might be the most impressive thing from a developmental perspective.
One of the best developmental programs, seems like, ever.
So is this just level. All offensive linemen and defensive backs?
I was going to say tight ends. That kind of stuff.
All developmental, like identifying that three-star. And then
I would say like a real true development.
Yes. It ain't a bunch of wide receivers, I can tell you that.
Yeah. And then Ole Miss at 40.
Yeah.
You know, Kiffin, that run, but still just the Ole Miss brand wasn't really – didn't mean that, and now it does. So that's always impressive.
The U and Florida State, if you grew up – if you're a Gen X and you grew up in the, you know, really first being aware of football in the late 80s and through the 90s, that's shocking, right?
Yeah, you would think
– U and Florida State – yeah. Well behind Iowa. That's really shocking. I think Cristobal is going to probably change that.
First Big 12 team that shows up, I think, is TCU here, right?
Yeah. So they're at 33. Remember that national championship run team put 8 guys into the league. So a quarter of their team, that their NFL guys, came from 1 year.
And if you're Gary Patterson, how pissed are you? You get fired the year before all of your seniors are like, and then he gets all the credit. That would be so frustrating, dude. Like, you get fired the year before you have 8 picks.
Well, and on top of it, Sonny Dykes doesn't even start the quarterback who eventually is going to lead them to the conference title and the national championship game. He had him second team until, what, the second game of the year?
Chandler Morris is his name, right?
Chandler Morris was the starter.
I never believed in him, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I never – because I remember watching him in the pocket, and he was he played scared. And so it's like that – I was never a big Chandler Morris believer. On the flip side, dude, I was actually a pretty big Duggan fan, but not because of all the intangibles, right?
Yep.
All the he's got heart kind of takes, which were accurate.
Yeah, I think Chandler Morris is going to be starting or competing for the starting job for Virginia this year. He's still in college football. Everyone's still in college football.
I was going to say, where else would he be? But not a big Chandler Morris guy, never was.
If you're one of the double eagle guys, seeing Texas Tech at 16 total players in the NFL, you're trying to double or triple that, right, to make Texas Tech a – relevant power.
I mean, that's exactly what they're doing with all these transfers. But don't skip, Paul. You skipped over the A&M right here.
A&M at 32, with the great Arkansas and Wisconsin.
Remember, with the greatest class of all time.
That is strange, right?
So that didn't pan out. So A&M still, Arkansas tied for A&M, which is like if you look at what A&M thinks of itself and then what Arkansas has been. That's where A&M's at, even with those recruiting classes.
Yeah, Arkansas has been is a double entendre you didn't intend, but is perfectly fitting.
That's right. Cool. And so it's like they did all this work. Look at our recruiting. Look at all this. And they still end up exactly where Arkansas is after they've been awful. Little bit uptick with Pittman, but not crazy.
You know, it's wild. Stanford still there with 30. The bottom's about to drop out on that one. I promise you.
Yeah. But I was going to say the same thing, that Stanford is still interesting there. Who do we got? SMU, Iowa State. SMU more than Iowa State's pretty interesting.
Well, SMU's going to be rising with a bullet in that regard, right? Yeah. They're going to put 3 to 5 guys in the league every year now, from now on.
Yeah. And then I wonder Iowa State's kind of scheme on defense, how – NFL coaches always relate to that. I mean, if they have an edge, they're going to take them and stuff like that. But whenever you play in a system that's not super NFL worthy, how that affects defenders too. They're always going to spam a wide receiver and make him look like a Heisman. That's their whole thing. And I like Rocco Becht, and I like Matt Campbell. But some of their – on offense and defense, they're so systematized. It can be a little tricky, but, you know, shout out Brock Purdy, right?
Yeah, they're kind of the perfect Big 12 embodiment of development cycles, sort of they've got a – you know their floor, and their ceiling isn't much different than their floor.
We got Crouch. You all said the very experienced Jaren Thompson was dropped because of physical limitations, kept them from running the whole playbook. That describes yours as well, but we stuck with him. Can't disagree on there. But it's a little bit different, I guess, unfortunately, at the quarterback position. There's more, clearly more safeties that were easily to bring in. It's not easy to bring in like a third year quarterback starter.
Also, Jaron Thompson, we knew. By the way, I really like Jaron Thompson.
So did I.
But he was one of many guys for different reasons that was limiting that defensive back group. It's why we had to turn that room over to be so good. Guys probably forget that we dropped basically eight guys in 1 year, eight defensive backs.
Yeah.
And two and a half of them were starters, right? And people don't believe this. If you go back and read the posts at the time, people were really worried and concerned about this defensive back room. And people were like, oh, Terrence Brooks, oh, that's a big loss. What are we going to do? And, you know, we're trying to tell people like, hey, like, the light hasn't turned on and we don't think it's gonna, so you got to move on. But the thing that is a little different about quarterback is there's a physical reality to a physically limited safety that's always going to limit what he can do in the defense, right? The thing with Ewers was he had improved every year until last year. So the kind of retrospective thing of, we always knew Ewers was, you know, this was his limitation, this was his ceiling. Well, he hadn't demonstrated his ceiling yet, actually, right? So he improved a lot from a freshman to sophomore. Sophomore year was his best year, right?
Yeah.
And then sophomore to junior, the expectation was, hey, another year in the offense, you know, good surrounding talent. Of course, we're gonna ride with Ewers and he's going to improve again. And that didn't happen for a number of reasons, both his limitations, but also his injuries. So it's a great observation, but it is a little bit of a different position. And it's almost a crapshoot with quarterback that you think, hey, another year in this offense and it's all going to come together for him. And sometimes that is the case, but you know.
Well, Jaron Thompson's thing was like pure foot speed. Like you're not going to go from getting burned all the time to fast.
Yes.
You know, so that was the thing too with Jaron Thompson. We love Jaron, like awesome. And I was super glad when he went to Auburn. I wanted him to get another opportunity. But remember, he was just getting cooked, like really bad routes. And so that's a big difference too. And also I think you can Sark can work with Quinn. He did. He turned him into the check down king. You know, it's like Sark was able to kind of tinker and give Quinn clear reads, even though I don't think he executed them at the highest level. But it's a little different for safety. And especially
your
safeties to replace you than there are quarterbacks.
As a safety, you're reacting to what the other guy is doing. When you're controlling a quarterback, you're able to basically create the groundwork for what things are going to look like. You can say, well, here are the throws he can make. Here's the things he can do. Here are the reads that I'm going to tell him to make. Jaron Thompson, you know, you're reacting to what the other offense wants to do and is trying to do to you. So, yeah, there's that element as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think broadly speaking, it is an interesting observation because there was a point in the season where you said, are we going to stick with Ewers and hope it gets better, or do we just need to turn the page right now? And that's not an – I don't think that was an easy – I think the further out we get from this, the more people are going to look back 10 years – and go like, oh man, Sark should have made a change. And yeah. I don't think at the time it was as clear or as obvious.
Yeah. I think it was really, you know, I've always had my issues with Ewers, but it was the Georgia game, dude, where I just kind of went like, all right, like this is, we've got to the top of this, you know, for him, even with injuries and stuff like that. But I still wasn't we need to change out for Arch. It seems much more clear now. I think you're correct. I think you explained it perfectly. Couldn't we have designed a game plan for Arch and ride with him? I mean, yeah, theoretically. But like we said, it's like hindsight's 20/20 on this.
Yeah, and also, you know, the guy still hasn't had a lot of reps. You know, it's awesome that he tore up Mississippi State and UTSA, but that's a little different than, you know, he did play against Georgia and Austin, if you'll recall.
Yeah, it didn't go great.
So, yeah. You know, understand that even this year, as good as Arch, I think, is, there's going to be some growing pains. There's going to be a couple of games. You're like, what are you doing? I mean, that's just.
Well, Mississippi State, too, is like, I love that tape. and it saw what he could do against a bad defense, but that was like bottom, what, 20 passing defense and one of the worst pass rushing teams in the country.
Yes.
I mean, like, they were lucky. If they got a sack a game, they were lucky. You know,
that was a great entree to getting your feet wet in the SEC. Like that was the, defense you pick of every, of 16 teams in the SEC. That's the one you'd pick to start your new quarterback in. So,
well, and I think Michigan really hurt too, right? Like if Quinn didn't have that performance in Michigan, that's made the decision even harder. And I hear the fans talk about that all the time. It's like, well, look at Michigan pre-injury, all of that stuff. I think it made it way more difficult. If Quinn would have just kind of struggled throughout, I think you could have seen a more forceful thing, but everyone was kind of trying to get back to this ideal with him. Hey, he'll get back to Michigan. Hey, he'll get back. And he just didn't, you know.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, if we'd won Michigan 13-10, it would have been a different conversation.
Because, I mean, that's all you hear was, well, the Michigan game. Now, I believe that's a mirage because Quinn was excellent at knowing what was going to happen and training all summer. We saw it with the previous two Bama games in Michigan. And then also, Sark schemes the hell out of those games, man. Like, so Quinn's made that same throw that they're going to score on 30 times in practice. He's seen that look 30 times. And I think maybe that's why we also struggle so much off script, because of Quinn. Now we have to see that. We're going to figure that out this year with Arch, actually, if that's a Sark or Quinn thing. But it seems like as soon as we had to get into the fight and things, you didn't know the next play was coming, Quinn's ability would drop off significantly.
Let me ask you this. I think Sark's ability to prepare the team for a big opener or a big marquee opponent early is really good, obviously, at Alabama, at Michigan, right? We've seen this before. What are you watching as Sark? What is Sark watching and preparing for with Matt Patricia? Because I thought we had a really good game plan against Ohio State, actually, in the playoff.
Yeah.
But it kind of got sabotaged by Golden going out for 2.5 quarters, right? That really hurt us.
Yeah.
And then we had some limitations, you know, but we understood that we needed to attack them with the running backs, right, when they were bringing those linebacker blitzes. And we did. We knew where to attack them with Golden. And had he stayed in the game, you would have seen even more success. However, what are you preparing for Patricia? Like, are you watching the old Detroit Lions and New England Patriots stuff? Like, what's Sark prepping? Because when we played Alabama, Sark knew exactly what defenses they were running, exactly what coverages they were going to run against certain looks. Like, it was all prepped.
Yeah.
So what are we doing for Ohio State? What do we know what Matt Patricia is going to run?
I don't.
Because the whole Belichick idea is you prepare week to week for each opponent.
Right.
And so Zach Williams in the chat says, hey, Patricia's going to run the Larry Johnson front scheme with different coverages. I mean, that's fair, but, you know, the front is less of the concern. It's more about what they're doing on the back end. Is it going to be a lot of zone blitzing? Is it going to be drop eight? Is it going to be, you know, mixed? Are they going to be mixing and matching zone and man, trying to pick off Arch, right? So, yeah, I mean, again, the front is fine. That's a lesser concern. You could adjust to that on the fly during game day, right? But it's the question of what are the coverages? What are the, you know, who's covering, you know, the tight end and the flat, that kind of stuff. So it's going to be very interesting. You know, are they concerned about Ryan Wingo and DeAndre Moore? Or do they treat them with like some contempt and bring pressure? So we'll see.
Yeah, I wonder how those DBs do in good on good versus their own team. Because, you know, often we're like, well, these guys play, you know, we'll say this all the time, I'm guilty of it. These guys see each other in practice every day. It's like, no, they don't. Like most times the ones are not up against the ones every day.
The twos certainly see the ones.
Yeah, the twos see the ones every day. But we always say like, well, they see this receiver in practice all the time. It's like, not really. But still, you're going to see Jeremiah Smith, Carnell Tate, Max Clair, whatever. So it's like, that's my thing too, is like, have the secondaries got to play against their guys because they have the best wide receiving core, and how do they look in that regard? And then how confusing do you want to be with Arch, you know? Do you have the ego of playing him straight up? Because you can go both ways. He's young, so we're going to play him straight up, or he's young, so we're going to be confusing. I mean, either logic line works there for a young player.
You know, so, it'll be very telling in this game. How much do we run Arch?
Well, I was going to say, this is the advantage, right? If they do get into confusion tactics, we do have some eraser ability that we didn't have last year. So if we got confused, you know, we didn't have a quarterback. If our quarterback got confused, it was a sack, dude. And this year, at least, if Arch does get confused, A, he can try to buy more time to create just because DB's covering that long, or he can run. So luckily we do have, and this is not the answer, but it is going to be a answer for probably a couple conversions, you know?
Yeah, so when I'm writing my preview, I was kind of looking at our offensive line. I was like, man, we're losing 150 starts, right? We're losing 100 starts just between Jake Majors and Kelvin Banks.
Yeah.
And that's center and left tackle. Like the two spots where you want the most starts on your offensive line.
Center's the one that always makes me the most nervous.
So I'm looking at all that. But then I was looking back at some film, and I think the offensive line is going to be leakier, but I think you'll have a quarterback who will be much better able to deal with the leaks, because boy, it was, I knew this. I was the one making the observation all year, frankly, you know, the stuff that NFL draft Twitter picked up 6 months later. It's like, boy, you know, Quinn is creating a lot of these sacks. He's not being very strong in the pocket. I went back and watched that first Georgia game. Georgia had 7 sacks on us. I would only attribute 2 of them to the offensive line.
Yeah.
So I just think that's going to be a big difference in this team. That, yeah, we're going to be leakier, but when Arch has a guy doing a flyby and it gets a hand on him as he's going by, Arch is going to shake it off and just step up in the pocket. Like it's not going to be auto sack. And so that's going to be a big difference. And it's hard to kind of put a handicap on that of what that's going to mean ultimately for your pass pro.
Cause by definition it's off schedule. So it's by definition, not easy to plot. So yeah. And then hopefully if Nato figures it out at guard, we're also more athletic in the run game at guard, between Campbell and Nato. Those are fast guards, and we're going to run pull schemes. So hopefully that can help out too, yet to be seen. But Zach Williams says Tampa 2 and cover 3 like last year. We'll probably run a little more man and buzz the hooks for our RPOs. Cover 3 match was a pretty effective coverage versus us last year. That was like the Vanderbilt game plan.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff. So we'll see if that's breaking Sark's scheme or if that was just messing with quarterback. Like I said, this year's really fascinating for me because it's going to answer a lot of questions. If these are global issues or they were just quarterback issues, I suspect, like most things in life, there's nuance and it's probably a little bit of both, but that's not as exciting to say that it's all one man's fault, apparently.
Yeah, and you know, Ohio State, their defensive line is going to be a lot smaller and less physical and not as deep at defensive tackle. That's for sure, right? If they've really got a weakness, we took all the portal defensive tackles. Like, so people were saying like, hey, that's what we're doing. We're playing keep away from Ohio State and, you know, other teams on our schedule. And it's like, hey, that was a tertiary benefit. We're bringing defensive tackle so we can get good at defensive tackle. Like,
yeah.
or be
it acceptable. Was funny though. It was like, dude, if we did that style of just, we don't even care if you're good. We just take,
we're just taking guys and then immediately like cut them when they arrive. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just being ruthless. But yeah, so that is going to be an interesting part, because if Ohio State can play a light box on us and we can't run the ball, like we can't push them around a little bit. If they do that, we're in a lot of trouble. But if they try to do that and we were able to run the ball, Ohio State's in some trouble, because now Sark can dictate their coverages.
Yeah. Wouldn't Sark typically go heavy motion to make Ohio State show their cards on the back end? Yeah, he can, but if they're in a zone, it won't matter because he won't.
Also, so that, I think Jason's thinking of that national title game of Alabama against Ohio State, where Ohio State ran out one of the dumbest game plans I've ever seen.
Where they let that mic try to cover and he's got cooked.
Yeah. I mean, so whatever you think of Matt Patricia and the stupid pencil behind the ear with the laminate and like all the weird stuff he does, he's like an NFL level defensive coordinator. So, you know, it's not going to, And he's not as predictable as the NFL level defensive coordinator we saw last year with Michigan, who, you know, even before that game, I was like, hey, everyone's all intimidated. He got fired by the Ravens for a reason. He became a one-trick pony. He got way enamored of his little schemes, and that continued. In fact, if you followed Michigan for the rest of that year, they cleaned up a lot of that stuff. They didn't have their best defensive tackle dropping into zone coverage anymore, right?
Well, then teams are figuring out this out more, man. Like Sark was doing that in 2020.
Yeah. But
they've seen the, you know, they've seen the tape. So it's also that. And like we said, if they're playing pure man, motion's going to give you a good idea. But if they're playing like a two high and then they're going to rotate to whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's not, motion is not as effective. Still effective. Don't get me wrong, but not as effective as it was like, say like 2020. Defense kind of adjusted, but there'll be ways. And like I said, Sark's really good with that. If he can nail down your scheme, he's going to learn how to break it, where you're weak. Every coverage has a weakness, and then he'll figure something out. But that will be interesting to see because he doesn't have a clear template on Patricia. Saban teams are easy because it's the Saban system. Like you can go back to the 90s with Saban teaching, you know? And I mean, I learned Saban system at a base level. If I can do that, imagine Sark. So,
well, I also think because there's going to be a lot of adjustments on both sides of the ball, this will be this feels like a game where one team's going to race out to a lead and then you're going to see that erode. And like, one of the two teams will get up by like 14 and then you'll see that it'll be a tight game late, like whoever else will make the adjustment. And then I don't see either team.
But that point is Ohio State has that advantage on us. We have the consistency. So normally it was us playing a consistent team and we could catch them by surprise. We're now the hunted in that regard schematically, that they know they have years of PK. They know what we like to play. So it could end up very, very well, even with a young Salen saying 14-0 Ohio State, like we're used to, and then we have to battle back. So that part's going to be kind of interesting. Before we keep going, though, guys, we need to hear a word from Academy Sports and Outdoors. In honor of your service and support for our country, Academy Sports and Outdoors is offering military and first responders 10% off your purchase, both in your local Academy Sports and Outdoors and online, all the way through July 4th. Exclusions do apply. Visit academy.com/discount for details. Ohio State's going to be an interesting...
Well, the other interesting thing, because Saban is a new quarterback and you look at our defensive roster, and man, I knew this intuitively and I was kind of making this an observation on Inside Texas, but writing the book really brought it home. We have never had this variety of blitzers and like stunters at linebacker, edge, even nickel, like Spence. So Brad Spence, Anthony Hill, and Trey Moore, our linebackers, right? Three of our linebackers combined for 21 and a half sacks last year at their respective schools. And two of them, of course, it was at Texas. So that's an incredible range of pass rushers to have at linebacker, right? You also have Colin Simmons on the edge, who's the best edge in the country. On the other edge, you've got a capable edge, at least at minimum. And if we're not getting withering pressure from that other edge, like Burke, they'll roll him inside on passing downs and they'll put Trey Moore on the line of scrimmage, right? Or they'll bring in Colton Vosick, right? First sort of uninjured offseason in his career. And he's a guy who keeps flashing over and over. So I just think that the array of different blitzers and guys that we can bring instant pressure with is going to be shocking. And that's really good for a young quarterback. So even a Jelani McDonald, if he plays nickel, that guy, he's going to be a very effective blitzer from nickel. And obviously PK loves the nickel blitz. That's like his default, let me disrupt something call. So you have all those different options. You can run them on stunts. You can do different stuff. That's just a nightmare for a young quarterback if you can start getting through. And Saban is, you know, probably 6 feet tall. So not a big stature guy, and you know, he's not going to shake off a rusher. He's not Will Howard. So I think if we stop Ohio State's passing game, it's going to have to happen at the point. It's going to have to happen at the quarterback, because if he gets a clean pocket and they get to run their routes over time, those wide receivers are going to beat us. They just will. They're the best in the country.
Yeah, whatever, Paul.
All right.
So this is where we talk about what PK could do for 5 minutes, and then he just does exactly what he normally does.
That's right.
Does PK play straight up as usual, or does he reach into his bag to rattle Sane?
It's the relevant question from Splenda Daddy, formerly Sugar Daddy.
Yep.
Sometimes we think he's going to come up with these game plans, and well, if we did this, it would be really effective. And then he just plays the base defense.
And it works.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah. I remember like both Georgia games, especially Georgia won. I was like, well, here's some things we could do. And Georgia's been struggling with Carson Beck. We just played our defense.
And he would still throw the ball right to us.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I think PK just laughs, or he's just like, guys, if it isn't broke, don't fix it.
Well, what he does is helps us generate content.
That's what he does. Yeah.
He is like, we're going to run a 1-7-3. And then PK just rolls out his defense.
I was going to say, yeah, Ian gets great weekly content of like what could happen. And then it's just like, 4-2-5. All right. Let's look at the newspeak world. Let's see. You guys are going to learn real good right now.
Oh,
okay. This is about strength of schedule, but how to really evaluate these things, how to think about football, a couple tiers up than the average person, because the risk of thinking in an average way or thinking with this style of language is it inherently limits how you view football, and it makes you wrong a lot. So let's begin with just being wary of how you even frame things in your mind. For instance, deadlock winner, sure thing, no way that's happening. What's going on there, Paul, when we do that?
Well, so it's a sort of linguistic framing that your vocabulary actually limits your perception of what the possibilities are. And so I kind of compared it to Newspeak in 1984. Great book, obviously, by George Orwell, that one of the observations he made is that by limiting, and the regime purposely limited vocabulary, expressive vocabulary, because they realized that limiting people's ability to communicate their thoughts actually makes them dumber. So it's not just that they're externally inarticulate. They actually train their minds to only see one or two options or have only certain gradations of ability to perceive things, right? So I think I read once that the intelligence is the art of making fine distinctions. Yeah. What the idea is, don't create a vocabulary around sports that trains you to think Sam Houston sucks, Kentucky sucks. Those are W's. Sam Houston sucks. Arkansas is going to suck this year. W's. Hey, Sam Houston does suck, and that's a W. You're right. Arkansas has a 7% chance of beating us, a 12% chance of beating us, whereas Sam Houston State has a 0.001 chance of beating us. Those two things are not the same.
Well, if I asked you to step out, if I said, hey, there's a 10% chance you're going to get hit by a car today, you would behave differently than if I said there was a 0.00001.
A 10% chance of being hit by a car is a shockingly high right. risk level of being hit by a car. You know, if we're at the beach and I'm like, hey, man, look, the big statistics are we're not getting attacked by a shark, Connor. You're being a puss. Like, go in the water.
But
it's dusk. Yeah. You're in an area full of bull sharks. We're in an estuary, and I've been cleaning fish near the boat, and we saw a shark fin earlier. That's a different risk assessment than, oh, come on, man. The big stats say you're not going to be attacked by a shark, Connor. Get in. It's a different conversation. So that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but the idea is even OU last year, OU was the 34th best team in if you look at FEI or FPI rankings, right? Power rankings. But they were a 6-7 football team. So compared to us, they were terrible. We played them. We beat them 34-3, right? Part of it is we matched up great with them. We also played well after a rocky first quarter. OU, you know, their great defense that they hung their hat on wasn't enough to suppress our offense, right? And once that happens, OU's dead, right? But in games where OU can suppress your offense, they actually are a pain to play, right? And 34th in the country, not exactly what we're aspiring to be at Texas, but that's not terrible, right? And so the point is, we're really poor at evaluating risk, small or marginal risk, over a large data set. Meaning that if you play a team that you're favored by to beat, you're plus 10 and a half, you know, minus 10 and a half when you play them, you're plus 400 on the money line, right? That means you have an 80% chance of beating that team. That is worlds apart if you played a team like that three times from playing a team that you beat 95% of the time.
Yeah, I think you have the math coming up here. I'm trying to
find it. People struggle with that. So if you play a team that you should beat 95% of the time three times, you have an 85.7% chance of going 3-0.
Here we go.
Now, I think to the average person, that actually seems low, right? Like, whoa, that, all right, well, we're still going to win. I mean, 85%, I like those odds. If you play a team that you should beat 80% of the time three times, 51.2%.
It's crazy.
Like a coin flip.
Yep.
That you're going to beat them three times. And people see that and they're like, well, I mean, that doesn't, I don't know about that. Well, do know about that, because that is how Alabama loses to OU in Norman, right? Yeah. After the bye week, even though they're terrible. Now, there's also football reasons, but there is just a probability aspect to some of this. So it's the idea of people struggle to understand probabilities, both discreetly and also a large data set. And if you're going to be a sports gambler or even just try to evaluate something at a sophisticated level, you really have to be aware of that, because we train our minds like the internet trains our minds, Connor. Everything's amazing or it sucks. And now they've introduced a new word, mid, which actually is supposed to mean the middle, the average, which would be helpful. But that just means you suck.
Yeah, exactly. Mid now.
Literally mid means you suck.
Yeah, mid means you suck. Yeah, there's no nuance.
So that's something you have to be aware of. And then I also think the larger probability. So I gave the example of if you flip a coin 1,000 times, it is completely unremarkable in that 1,000 coin flip data set that you would come up with heads 7 times in a row. That is unremarkable. That's expected to happen within random probability. Also, if you ask the average person, if I flip a coin 1,000 times, it's a fair coin, it's a fair flip, we don't need to get all sidetracked, it's a dirty coin. How many times, or what's the likelihood that it gets 500 heads and 500 tails? Ask a normal person that question and you'll get bizarre answers. Some people will answer that question 100% of the time. They'll say you get, or they'll say 80% or 20. Or some will say never, it can't happen. The answer is it happens 2.52% of the time. So exactly what you think might happen, half heads, half tails, actually quite rare.
Yeah.
So the point is, even over large data sets, what would seem intuitively the most likely outcome is not. And so Vegas, you may notice if any of you guys bet, that FanDuel and DraftKings are always sending you NBA parlay bonuses. And the reason they want you to parlay is, one, people aren't very good at understanding averages, right? Like, this guy averages 17 points a game, so surely he'll score 16 in this game, right? But they also don't understand aggregations of small risk. And so that's kind of the issue, is if you play that, we're going to beat this team 80% of the time team, guaranteed win, man. That's a W, right? You play them enough times, and it's actually pretty likely that they're going to beat you one time. And that's why legal sports gambling is a $125 billion industry. And when you go to Vegas, all the buildings are really, really nice. But parlays are fun. They are. So that's why I always laugh, because I write the Beating Vegas column, and I think the last few years I'm at about 58, 60% picking winners with the spread. And people will be like, well, use your 6 recommendations. And I'm all happy because I went 5-1 or 4-2.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I did it on a parlay and I still lost. It's like, all right, man.
Yeah.
So don't parlay. And if you do parlay, do it with $2 and realize it's fun money and you're throwing it away.
Yeah, trying to make it an all upside thing.
That's right.
Yeah, you're not even – yeah, it's take that more as a lottery ticket.
That's right.
But, yeah, so this framing in your mind, how you think about football is going to matter, especially when you're dealing with the people that put their real money where their mouth is. But the question, Paul, is still like, well, where are the losses even going to come from, dude?
That's a key question. But before we answer that question, Connor, I want to tell you a place that you're always going to win. The probabilities say 100% you're going to win when you call this number to do your mortgage. That number, get your pen, get your pencil out. If you don't have one handy, cut your finger and write in blood. 832-557-1095. That will connect you with Mortgages by Gabe Winslow. Great guy. Gabe is really good at what he does. Over 20 years in the industry, UT grad, former National Merit Scholar, law degree, really knows this industry inside and out. He's been in it for a long time. He's been on every side of that table. He also used to run a title company. He's just a guy that gets it done. He's also a broker. Connor, he's going to go shop your deal to 50 or 60 different people who housing market ain't exactly flying right now, Connor. So they're bidding. They're trying to give you the best possible, most aggressive rate. And if you don't go with a guy like Gabe, with his capabilities, his capacity, and the fact that he's a broker, and you go with Big Bank USA, you ain't going to get the best rate. You ain't going to get the best deal. And they're going to structure the deals very frequently in very deceptive ways that are not to your benefit. Give Gabe a call. Be taken care of. Look at the contempt that Connor has for big banks. 832-557-1095. I hope Chase or Wells Fargo is not a future sponsor.
I hope they are a future spot. That would be very nice.
Yeah, then we'll just change our tune entirely and be like, hey,
you know what?
Lazy bankers are your best bet. Lazy commercial bankers who roll in at 9:30 and leave around 3. Yeah. That's who you want to do your business with.
Don't be confused with all these good rates. There's just
don't be confused by hardworking brokers. Let's stick with the knitting.
Yeah. Gabe's the guy though. Don't listen to us and don't listen to the big banks. Okay, guys. So you're sitting there and you're going, all right, cool numbers, dorks. What does this actually mean for us? And now Paul's about to deliver the practical advice for the Texas Longhorns, not just for you gambling sickos. Okay. So the first, we also want to avoid you from thinking purely of where the losses are. Okay. We want you to kind of think in probabilities. It's hard to do. It's not a natural thing for us. That's why it's a whole field. I mean, it's the whole field. It's counterintuitive. But that's to help you in the long run of how to really think about this sport and wins. Think of things in kind of, Paul will do it for you, but kind of in chunks. To me, it's like a rough, like pick 3 games. Think about how you come out there opposed to just wanting each game separately as an event. So let's see.
That all said, we can put W's next to UTEP, San Jose State,
correct,
and Sam Houston.
Yes. That,
we're good. We're good there.
We can beat the laws of probability there because they are so insignificant. But all right, let's first talk about that the conferences are not the same.
Right. So part of this is we talked about that difference between a 95% likelihood team and 80% likelihood team. And you're like, well, they both suck. We're going to beat both of them. They don't both suck in the same way. There's gradations of suck. And as an analyst of suck, it's my job to tell you that there's a big difference because, as we said, if you play a bunch of those 95% teams, you're good. If you play a bunch of those 80% teams and you put them in the same category as that 95% team, you're not good because over time, you're going to lose one of those games, just guaranteed by probability. So that relates to the SEC. The bottom and middle of the SEC are just objectively better than the bottom and middle of the other three P4 conferences. Now, that can be overdone. People are like, you know, Auburn would go win the, you know, Big Ten. If they, you know, it's like, no, that's not true. Big Ten actually has elite teams at the top, obviously. But the middle and bottom of the Big Ten, year to year, not great. And I got to tell you, the middle and bottom of the ACC, really not great. Like, these are – one of the reasons you should like Clemson is, one, they're good probably in and of themselves. But two – they're going to have long stretches of the season where they can hold back plays, hold back snaps, hold back players for health. And they're still going to go cruise and beat the hell out of Stanford and Wake Forest.
Well, also, you make a good point, right? So we'll say like, well, this team hasn't played anybody, so they're going to get exposed. Not necessarily, because like Paul said, they might have been able to hold back everything, stay healthy. It actually might be an advantage when we think they're going to get exposed, that they've had an easier path and they're not as beaten down by war. So that matters too.
Yeah, and so that is the whole idea of Michigan in 2023. They had a terrible non-con. They had a feeble Big Ten schedule. And people are like, well, they're going to get exposed. It's like, no, actually, they're a good team, that really good team that never played good teams until they played Ohio State. They won that game, and then they won their playoff game, or the two playoff games, right? Both close competitive games. Although Washington, Michigan just matched up like perfectly with them, right? So that's the thing to pay attention to. So why don't some SEC teams want to play nine SEC teams? One, there's a higher probability of a loss. There's a higher probability of losing to SEC team X, fill in X, than my FCS Tennessee Martin that I schedule if I'm Ole Miss or Tennessee, right? That's like typical SEC scheduling. And part of that is just job preservation. You know, part of the sell, if you're a lower or mid-tier SEC team, is, hey, we're SEC. And we play these four joke non-cons that we go 4-0, and then we go 3-5 and 2-6 in conference play, and we go to a bowl, and we have a winning record or whatever, and we're SEC, and so all of our fans are happy, and we keep our jobs, right? There's even an upper middle class group of the SEC, like Ole Miss, who says, hey, we're going to go 5-3 in SEC play. You know, we're pretty good. We're a pretty good football team. But we're also going to schedule this week non-con, go 4-0, and now our fans are all fired up because we're elite. We're a 10-game winner.
Yep.
So that is another reason too. And so it's kind of just cowardice. It's reasonable caution based on some of the statistical stuff we discussed. It's also cowardice, which is we got to pick up these wins so I can keep my job. Because no one wants to hear about our awesome power ranking when we go 5-7. They would rather replace two of those games with scrubs, guaranteed wins, and we go 7-5, even though we might not be as good a team, or we might be exactly the same team. But suddenly everyone feels good about themselves.
It's going to be the Florida problem, like where they have these killer schedules that like analysts could be like, this could be one of the best teams in the country.
That's right.
Everybody would be like, Florida sucks. You see how many losses they have?
Yeah, I mean, Florida could go 8-4 and be one of the best 12, 14 teams in college football easily.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's hard for people to account for because they're like, well, I watched them and they got beat. And yeah. It's like, well, they're also playing Georgia and Texas like every week.
Dude, I read their schedule the other day and I was like, this is horrific.
Yeah. LSU and Ole Miss are like their breaks.
Yeah.
Right?
Dude, it's horrific.
It's crazy. But so, I mean, that's a team where I do go crazy when people are talking about the playoff of like, I don't care if you lose three games. No, you don't have a say. It's like if you play Georgia and Texas and LSU and Ole Miss every week. Miami, yeah. 9-3 means you're bad.
Miami to Tennessee. Like,
yeah. Like I don't want to hear all that. So anyway, that's the larger point. And it doesn't have anything to do if you say the SEC top to bottom is the best league. That doesn't mean the SEC has the best team, right?
Right.
Because the retort on dumb journalist Twitter is, well, if the SEC is the best league, how come Michigan and Ohio State won two national titles back to back? And it's like, well, that's a non sequitur. That is nothing. Like, we're not saying that they have the best team. We're saying they're the best top to bottom.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're as good top to bottom as the ESPN's FPI says, which is,
yeah,
11 of the top 18 teams are SEC.
Yeah,
13 of the top 25. I'm not sure I buy that. That seems aggressive, but it does give you some perspective.
Yeah, even if they're off by 20%, that's still a lot of teams you have to face in the SEC.
And that is why, Connor, here's the other thing that's hard. So depending on the metrics and sort of where people are eyeballing our schedule or people are doing the math, we have the fourth hardest strength of schedule in the country by the metrics. If you just eyeball our schedule, I think the casual Texas fan goes, well, we just really have two hard games, Ohio State and Georgia. We'll split those. So we're going to go 11-1, man. Show me the loss, bro, right? We're not losing to A&M. We're not losing to OU. We're not losing to at Kentucky, whatever.
So that's where probabilities come into play.
And that's where probabilities come in. So rather than just splitting, say, for example, Georgia, Ohio State, the most likely probabilities, if you just put it on pure probability, is 1-1 or 0-2. It ain't 2-0, right?
The most likely options, yeah.
Yes. And then when you string together, say, at Florida, OU, neutral, hosting A&M, most likely outcome of those three games, 2-1. And people are like, you look at it individually, oh, A&M's ass. They're all, you know, OU sucks. Florida, what if Lagway gets – I mean, that's – we can do all that, and that's fine.
And we will sometimes during the offseason.
Well, and actually, we will the game week. If Lagway is hurt, everything's changed, right?
Yeah.
But the point is, if you look at it right now, the most likely outcome of those three games is 2-1.
And we don't know who the one is.
And we don't know who the one is.
Yeah.
And so then the worst part, and this is why we talked about the SEC not wanting to do, or at least parts of the SEC not wanting to do the 9-game schedule. I think Texas is cool with it, actually.
Because we want, because OU steals one of our home games a year.
And also because we like money.
But yeah, but that's the thing. It's like
guy in Idiocracy. I like money.
But we get one less home game a year because we play at the Cotton Bowl. So that's why they want that ninth game, because it's like you said, money, revenue generating.
Correct. I think if you put that, you took the SEC and you put it to anonymous ballot and you had the SEC teams vote, I bet we play an 8-game schedule. And I bet the vote's like 10-6, 9-7. However, we could just have the bullies of the SEC and the commissioner just tell everyone we're playing 9 games.
Or you could say vote publicly.
Or vote publicly. Yeah. And now, so it's not so much that Vanderbilt would vote for 8 games, right? It's that now Ole Miss or OU or A&M has to make a public vote saying we want 8 games. And that's a different deal. So anyway, and then so the point is, even in our SEC teams that we should beat, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Arkansas, again, these aren't we're going to beat those teams 98% of the time. It's we're going to beat those teams 88% of the time.
Now you're stacking them.
And that's a difference, right? There's a difference there. It's a difference in order of magnitude. The good news is these things adjust as you play the schedule. So, for example, going back to the heads, you know, this is going to blow everyone's minds, right? But going back to the coin toss thing, before 10 coin tosses, you can calculate the odds of 10 heads in a row. Very low. Very low. However, 10 head tosses, that can happen. Because if you threw it 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times, that's actually an unremarkable thing that would occur. As you're doing each toss, your probability for that toss is individual. It's 50-50. After you do that toss, it doesn't affect your future tosses.
Right.
And that's what people really struggle with. The difference that's a little bit with like a power ranking is as Texas plays people and accumulates data points, and as our future opponents play people and accumulate data points, both of our power rankings can shift from the preseason. So,
but that's also why you see like FPI will simulate 1,000 games.
Right.
You know, they're, so it's like they're, that's what they're trying to solve for.
So and it that blows people's minds that when they simulated Texas OU last year, a game we won by 31 points and basically dominated, right? It's hard for people to imagine that in those 1,000 simulations, there was a simulation where OU wins the game 31-14. Mm-hmm. People are just like, that's not possible. I watched those two teams. If we played 1,000 times, that is an outcome. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting. And you know, I don't even like to like ponder that kind of stuff. It's like you're getting into like Doctor Strange mode where I've pondered this outcome with Thanos a million times and whatever. And then that's when people are like, don't tell me the odds, right? Yeah. I'm a winner.
This is a thing that it is important if you have any interest in analytics, and also if you're an analytics hater, this might be your fundamental flaw. So we'll see, like, you know, Parker Stats of War will release, like, his, you know, his advanced stat preview. And then he'll give a percentage, right? That Texas wins this game 80% of the time, and the other team wins 20%. Well, then the next week, Texas goes on to get upset, right? And they and Texas does get beat. Someone will always come back and say, Parker C, you were wrong. You only had them winning 20% of the time. They won. People don't understand if you, like, go to a Chuck E. Cheese. I go to Chuck E. Cheese too much because my nieces and nephews. but like, you know the games where the thing is moving and you try to press the button and stop it, right? If you look at 100% winning, here is the 20% and here is your 80%. This thing is moving back and forth theoretically the whole time. Wherever it stops, if it stops on the 20%, that 80% that Texas won is still there. It didn't disappear. You just stopped on that 20%. And people aren't able to think like that. And that's what probabilities is. So it's like our percentage of winning. So even if the team does upset, it doesn't invalidate the numbers. Parker was right. That was one of the 20% where that team won. It doesn't invalidate all the analytics. And people really struggle with that concept.
How convenient, Connor.
Yeah.
So Connor, so he's always right.
Yeah.
Because how convenient.
That's how percentages work, you know? And so it's like, but that's the thing that drives me nuts that you have to deal with. And I think often, man, like when you're getting into math, people don't like math, you know, and they don't like to do it. So they're looking for any reason to say, you know, it's not valid, just so they don't have to go learn, like, even with the advanced analytics, these things don't matter. These things are records of things that have occurred on the field. These aren't made up numbers. Okay. So it's like, no matter what, we might put them in a ratio or weight them differently, but these are stats are historical events. That's what occurred. There were 18 passes on the field. This isn't math. It's recording. It's doing a little tick every time there are 18. And people somehow like turn these into magical things that therefore they make no sense. It's frustrating. Don't just dismiss something because you don't understand it or want to understand it, because you can't understand it with like 20 minutes of work.
Well, the best part is writing these two articles. People in the comments are like, so who do we lose to?
I know. That was my favorite part. So Paul wrote out this whole thing about how you can't think like that. The second comment on the IT thread was like, well, show me the losses.
Show me the losses, bro.
We're just like, all right, dude.
Well, here's a question. Not mathematical necessarily, but rhetorical. Can you name another preseason number one? And Texas is the preseason number one in several publications, right? Even some power stuff, indexes. That is the underdog in two regular season games, even before the season starts?
No, I wouldn't even, that's a very specific situation to think of.
But like, we're the underdog in our opener.
Yeah.
We're the underdog at Georgia in Athens. And by the way, at Florida, I don't know what the line would be right now, but I don't think it's like Texas -7. If anything, if Texas is favored at all, it's like Texas -1.5. So kind of interesting. I have never seen a prospective national champion who's already regarded as an underdog and basically a pick 'em in three games before the season even starts.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
So that's – yeah, I don't know who is – I'm trying to think. Is Georgia just favored in every game?
Yes, I think they are.
Weird. Maybe it's probabilities, Paul.
Well, it is probabilities because being favored in every game, as we just discussed, doesn't mean you win every game. In fact, it's very unlikely you win every game.
Yeah, and especially against your strength of schedule. So, but yeah, that's a good point. That is weird. But also, here's kind of the point too. I think we've said that our floor is a 9-3.
Yeah,
regular season.
Our realistic floor of like our pets' heads aren't falling off, right?
Yeah.
Like, I guess there's true disaster scenarios where we're less than 9-3, but a lot of really bad stuff would have to happen. Right. Yeah.
So this is the floor too. This is not what we're saying. We're saying this is the bottom of our range in a realistic setting. But that can make your instant thing here is when we say the three, your brain's going to jump to bro football and say, well, who are the three? We can't tell you who the three are because we're trying to tell you. You got to think of probabilities. Because
it's a secret.
Yeah, it's a secret to the math gods. Dr. Strange knows. But that's the big thing. We can't tell you who the losses are going to be. We're just playing the odds here. All right, playing the low range of our odds here, not even playing the thing. All right, anything else, Paul?
No, I kind of end it with a little jab at the games on the field have to matter, losses matter, crowd, which is Michigan, if you look, they have a really favorable Big Ten schedule. And other than OU, a very favorable non-con. I think, and also Michigan and OU are basically probably going to be roughly evenly matched, right, in that game. And it's at OU. They're, right now, it looks like they have the 38th hardest schedule in college football, which for a Big Ten team is – that's a pretty good draw of the cards.
Yeah.
If they go 10-2 and we're 9-3, they have one less loss. I mean, don't the games have to matter, Connor? They have one less loss than we do. So they should get the nod in the playoff as an at-large over us, right?
That's where it's like, dude, baseball and basketball have figured it out.
Well, they also play each other a lot.
I was going to say, so here's the difference. You have to solve for a lot of – you want, A, more games, right? But also you need a ton of cross-conference proof. Let me just run this by you. I don't want to turn this into a topic. But here's my thought process. Let's not – just see if this solves the issue. We're not going to talk about all the cascading effects. Everyone goes to a 9-game schedule. All the Power Four. You have 3 non-cons. Your 3 non-cons has to be one from each of the other conferences. So you're going to play Big 12, you're going to play Big 10, you're going to play ACC. Everyone does that. Now, I don't even know if those numbers line up perfectly, like if there's 16 and 14 teams in this, blah, blah, blah. But at that point, and you don't play any G5s, there's none of that stuff. At that point, do you think you can do legit strength schedule?
It improves a lot. It gets better. It does. But the problem is, so the truth is, these aren't pure strength of schedule rankings, these FPI, because FPI, as you know, includes stuff like how did you recruit or how long has your coach been there? But
that's using FPI as the strength of schedule. I'm talking like
that's what I'm saying is that is part of the input of the metric of the strength of your schedule. So I don't think you can do that with, you know, college baseball.
But it's just, that's what's so annoying. We have to solve for this or we're perpetually going to be in this 9-3 Texas 10-2 Michigan problem.
Yeah. I mean, in 10-2 Michigan was, you know, that could be replaced that with what if Liberty and Boise State both go undefeated in G5?
Correct.
People are going to be saying like the games, look, all I know, you're going to hear this from an analyst. All I know is Liberty, every time they went out and played a game, they won that game.
They didn't pick their schedule.
And all I know is that when Texas went out, you saw what happened to them in Athens. Like, you know, like that's the thinking, right?
No, and that's why I'm trying to solve this with like a real metric that is announced before the season that tracks every week. So even if you're mad, you can be mad for 11 weeks because you know for 11 weeks that this is a thing, you know? So it's like,
well, so your proposal is great. It will never happen because of job preservation, right?
Yeah.
People want to keep their jobs.
Yep.
I would just be delighted if we could get teams to stop playing FCS teams.
Correct.
I mean, at least schedule a G5. At least schedule Colorado State.
Yeah.
Like, why are you playing Tennessee Martin? Why are you playing Duquesne?
I mean, like, spring games are tougher than these teams.
By far.
I know. I mean, because you're playing a college-level team.
Dude, Texas's second team would route Duquesne, right? Yeah. So I'll just be delighted if we can just get people to stop scheduling FCS teams. Like, at least schedule G5s for your wins.
But this is ultimately, too, why the SEC is disincentivized from going forward. Because we said you just increase the probabilities of another loss if you're an SEC team due to a fairly healthy middle and lower class in the SEC that's not present in the other leagues, even though the top of the leagues are the same or even better the past couple of years for the Big Ten. All right, Paul. Enjoyed hanging out with you, dude. It was real fun. Chat, thank you guys as well. That was real.
Once the math came out, chat immediately began saying, "Hey, is anyone going up to Lexington for the Kentucky game?"
What did let me see.
What are some of the horse races I should be catching?
Splendid Daddy. Has anyone been to Athens? Is it worth the trip? As soon as he started talking probabilities, people were like, oh, where are you guys going on vacation?
Yeah, our stream viewers, you know, just
no, I watched it to be sure. It did go up.
Wow, amazing. Yeah,
there's some, I have the gauge on it because there's sometimes we get into topics and you just see a precipitive drop off, and I'm like, all right, time to move to the next topic.
But I think some statistics and engineering majors heard and started texting their friends like, hey,
yeah,
you got to get on this YouTube video.
Yeah.
They're doing math. They're doing public math.
Public math. But yes, but these things are important, y'all. But this ends today's episode of Football Math School. Paul, thanks so much. Chat, thank y'all. This is IT Live, brought to you by the one and only Academy Sports and Outdoors. Later, y'all.